You're listening to the European Tour Race to Dubai show with Dan Roebuck and Richard Boxall.
Hello and welcome to the Race to Dubai show as Brooks Koepka gets his hands on the US Open trophy for a second successive year.
I looked at all these names a million times, it felt like, last year. Just looking at everybody, and you know, to have my name on there twice is pretty incredible, and to go back to back is even more extraordinary. It feels so special, and I'm truly honored to go back to back.
We'll hear more from Koepka later in the show. Race to Dubai champion Tommy Fleetwood was second at Shinnecock Hills after a stunning final round 63.
It's been a great day. It's easy to look at it and think I was one shy, and you can be disappointed, but there's so many positives to look at and so much that you can take from it and learn from it. And again, it's another major where I've ended up sort of up there at the end of the day. Majors and tournaments are 72 holes, so it doesn't matter how you kind of do it. If you end up there at the end of the week, it's a positive.
We'll bring you a full review of the major action from Long Island, plus we'll preview the BMW International Open in Germany. Hello, I'm Dan Roebuck, and today I'm joined by European Tour winner Richard Boxall. Boxy, how are you?
I'm all right. I'm a little uncleansed, I have to say, this morning.
What's the story behind that?
Well, I woke up this morning and the mains had gone. There had been a burst water main.
I see.
And I had to pop to a local supermarket. I won't mention
for
the name.
A shower?
Not so much for a shower, but just a few things you normally would do in the morning. Brush your teeth, etc., etc. It's amazing how much you rely on water, to be honest. Anyway, do you want to get to the US Open?
Why not? Yeah, Brooks Koepka, of course, holding off an unbelievable charge from Tommy Fleetwood at Shinnecock Hills to become the first man to successfully defend the US Open title in 29 years. Koepka entered the day in a share of the lead with Fleetwood six shots behind him, but when the Race to Dubai champion signed for a brilliant record-equalling 63, he was just one stroke behind the American. Koepka signed for a 68, one over par total for the week, and a one-shot victory. There's an awful lot to talk about, Boxy, when it
there
comes
is.
To the US Open, but
yeah.
In terms of that last day performance from Koepka and Fleetwood, they were both fantastic, and Koepka, a deserved winner.
I think so, yeah. I thought he held it together very well. I think it helped quite a bit that he played with Dustin Johnson, who's a good mate of his. You know, I was listening to the commentary. They go out and you go on holiday. Vacation is the word they use in America, isn't it? We use the word holiday. Yeah, and they stick together and they got on quite well. I did think it was quite funny at one point when Koepka said to him, Dustin, he says, this is a pitch mark here. And he said, oh, he said, I'm not sure. He said, you better go and ask somebody else. Are they really mates? No, he held up well because, you know, Tommy Fleetwood did the thing of got in the clubhouse, and I don't know what he waited, 2 hours, 2 hours and 20 minutes probably till the finish of it. If it had been the day before, I think Tommy Fleetwood would have cruised it, yeah. He ran out of holes, unfortunately, at the end. He liked the day to sort of keep going, but he had his chance on 16 and 18. But they're so hard, those greens. They're so difficult. But, you know, he hit the putts exactly how he wanted to. And, you know, from a man that had to go back to South Africa and get his playing rights back, you know, not 18 months ago, but a fair few years ago, he's come an awful long way.
Do you think that he knew potentially he would have a chance to win when he was putting on 18? Putting for birdie.
Yeah, I think he probably would have done, yeah. On the respect.
There were a lot better scores from a lot more players, obviously,
yeah,
on the Sunday.
The course was
Saturday.
Set up a lot better. It was softer. It wasn't as breezy. If it had been as breezy as, let's say, on Saturday, the greens would have quickened up quite a bit and all kinds of funny things could have happened. But I thought yesterday that it was the best the course had been set up in 4 days. I thought it was fair in respect of if you didn't get it out in the middle of the club, it would find you out and you'd shoot at 78 or 9. But if you did get it out in the middle of the club and you were playing well, the chance was there, hence the 63 from Tommy Fleetwood.
So how good was the 68 under pressure from Brooks Koepka then?
Brilliant. I thought it was fantastic. Two under par. And, you know, I always look at the US Open and you shoot, I'll get that out in a minute. You see 68 in the last round, that's two under par. In my mind, with some of those holes that are 512, 521 yard par fours, it's almost four under. You know, he's played fantastic golf. Okay, they went the last group off, but it's almost everybody forgot about Berger and Finau. You know, they sort of drifted away quite early on, didn't they? With
they
few
were
drop
almost
shots.
Expected to, though, weren't they?
Yeah, they were. They were. I mean, you know, they never thought they were going to be in the last group off when they signed their cards on Saturday for 66s, did they? No chance.
In terms of Koepka, Boxy, obviously
yeah.
He had time out because of a wrist injury earlier
yeah.
this season. It makes his win even more special, obviously back-to-back from last year as well. I mean, a sensational performance. I mean, when you've had months out of the game to build up fairly quickly to that level.
I think it goes to show how mentally strong he is, you know.
We're going to talk about the condition shortly, but okay. I'm pleased to say that Bob Bobka joins us, as per usual, when it comes to a major. Bob, as I mentioned, we'll talk about course setup and the first 3 days of competition in just a sec. But first of all, your initial reaction to Koepka's win yesterday.
Simply incredible, but ironically enough, on Tuesday, the USGA did something they have never done before. They invited all the USGA champions from last year to come to Shinnecock, and they were on the 10th tee. They were going to put on an exhibition, just a two-hole exhibition, and the master of ceremonies was going to be Jack Nicklaus. And I happened to be standing up there talking to Jack, and then all of a sudden, Brooks Koepka comes over. So I back away and give Brooks and Jack their opportunity to talk. But I was within earshot. So, and Brooks, the first question out of his mouth was, Jack, you know, I've won a major, but I don't want to be happy just winning a major. Can you give me some advice on maybe some direction, maybe some tips, anything on how I can increase the amount of majors I win? I just don't want to be satisfied. And I'll tell you, Jack Nicklaus took about 30 minutes saying different things, and really Brooks Koepka walked away from that session extremely motivated. Now, I'm not saying that Jack is the reason that he won. Obviously, it's his talent. But the mere fact that Brooks Koepka was wise enough to go to the gentleman that's won more majors than anybody and solicit some help on the formula, I thought was pretty incredible.
Bob, the final pairing yesterday were Messrs. Finau and Berger. Behind that, of course, we had Koepka and Johnson. And given what happened to Dustin Johnson on the third round and how Brooks Koepka played on the Saturday, do you think Brooks was favourite going into the final day?
Well, you know, the funny thing about Brooks Koepka, they're dear friends, Dustin Johnson, Brooks Koepka. They work out religiously together, not only in the morning, but in the evening. They spend a tremendous amount of time in the gym. All you have to do is take a look at the guns that Brooks is supporting, and you can tell that he works out a lot. But if we analyze their games, Brooks hits it as far as Dustin Johnson. Johnson gets all the credit for being this unbelievably long driver of the golf ball. Brooks is right there. Their iron games are fairly similar. Brooks Koepka is a better short wedge player and perhaps even a better putter than Dustin Johnson, who's only the number one player in the world. So if your talents exceed the best player in the game, you know, obviously you have tremendous talents of your own. So I don't know who really the favorite would be between those two. I could see them playing 10 times against one another, and five would be won by Johnson, five would be won by Koepka.
Yeah, I think you're probably right there, Bob. It's pretty even Stevens, isn't it, really? Justin Rose, though, I thought the winner would be either Koepka, Johnson, or Justin Rose. You know, all of them have won a US Open. Nobody feels like, you know, you really want your mummy when you're standing on that first tee, don't you, in the final round?
Absolutely. I had a good feeling about Justin Rose. You know, he survived Saturday. He's hitting every fairway and missing every green. You know, certainly not the formula for success. And when you're playing Shinnecock, if you're missing greens, you know, you're really opening up you know, the box to all kinds of trouble. But he hung in there. But he hung in there on, you know, the style that Justin Rose has grown accustomed to demonstrating. You know, he's very cool and calculated and confident. And I really thought he was going to be firing on all cylinders in that fourth and final round. It didn't happen. But, you know, it was out there. I mean, look at Tommy Fleetwood. I mean, Tommy Fleetwood probably for the next 6 months is going to be thinking about the birdie putt that he missed on 18, just hit it a hair too soft. I mean, just a touch of pace, and that goes in, and he shoots 62, and who knows what we'd be talking about.
You mentioned the two Englishmen there. Justin Rose, of course, double bogeyed for bogeyed the fifth, and therefore was always behind the eight ball to a certain extent. Tommy Fleetwood was brilliant picking up birdies on the second, the third, the sixth and the seventh, not to mention four on the spin on the back nine. But players like Tony Finau, and I'm going to ask this to Bob and to Boxy, and Daniel Berger got off to awful starts. But Boxy, you first of all, was the pressure just a little bit too much for those two, do you think?
Felt a bit sorry in a way, because it was almost as if they go, right, there goes Koepka, there goes Johnson, let's pull the shutters down now. Those two are playing, but they're not going to win it. So, you know, you could tell that because our on-course commentator from Sky, Rich Beam, went with the second last group. And let me tell you, as a player, when you see the on-course commentator go with the second last group, they go, they think we've got no chance.
It's always going to be difficult, isn't it, for Finau and Berger, not the household names, Bob. Tony Finau of the two potentially is the one that might kick on and become a major champion, or have I got that wrong? What are your thoughts on those two final round?
It's easy to dismiss the talent of Daniel Berger because he doesn't look, like a golfer. I mean, he certainly doesn't look nearly as strong as Brooks Koepka. His swing is somewhat unusual, but he's a gritty competitor, and he continues to get better. I mean, he's won twice on the PGA Tour. I mean, so he has credentials, and I think down the road, I know that he's a hard worker, and you know, he's got a great attitude. Is there a major in his future? I mean, that's so hard to say. I mean, you know, I've been with Colin Montgomery and Luke Donald and Lee Westwood. And you know, all three of those had massive amount of talent compared to Daniel Berger. But, you know, talent alone doesn't win majors. You got to be in the right place at the right time where somebody else doesn't do something that's, you know, off the charts. But I like his talent. I mean, and Tony Finau, believe it or not, you look at him, he looks like a young kid. He has four kids. I mean,
yeah. So do I, Bob.
Well, I know. Well, it ruined your golf game, that's for sure.
Doesn't help when you get rid of two houses, I can assure you that. Bob, you've really thrown me off my next question to you now. What the hell was it? Keep talking, Dan, and I'll remember what the question was.
Bob, your thoughts on Patrick Reed? He got off to a brilliant start. Five birdies in the first seven holes. He led by one. Could you see Patrick going? Because obviously players were looking to get off to fast starts, and knowing what happened in previous days, they were eyeing glory, weren't they, if they could get themselves in a good position?
Good question, Dan. And, you know, what I witnessed in Patrick Reed, you know, we were impressed with his victory this past April. You know, gets that green jacket on, has handled it very well. You know, he's done everything that the Augusta people could hope to get from their champion. Yet he continues to improve. He's an awfully hard worker. His mechanics are pretty solid. His confidence level, you know, can't be any higher. I kind of have reached a point now where I'd be surprised, really surprised, if Patrick Reed only has one major when he decides to hang it up.
Yeah, I agree with you there, Bob, as well. But do you not think, I mean, Bob, you're at a lot of these WGCs and majors, and we all put a lot of emphasis on the four majors, which is, you know, that's fair enough. But do you not think that, you know, the WGCs and the large tournaments and the majors all sort of roll into one? So winning a major for the likes of Berger or something would become a lot easier because of the WGCs and other events that they play and that are very large?
You know, that's a different perspective, and I really haven't heard that before, Richard, but it makes a lot of sense. You know, prior to the World Golf Championship events, you only had four opportunities a year on, you know, golf's biggest stage. And with the maturity of the Players' Championship now, that certainly has the feel of a major. The World Golf Championships have the feel of a major. So you have many more opportunities to do well. Yeah. When the major does come around, that's a very valid point.
Bob, obviously, Tommy Fleetwood with a 63 on Sunday, following a 78 on Saturday. And Boxer, you can chip in here. Just tell me and tell our listeners what the difference was in terms of course setup, not necessarily weather, but course setup between round three and round four. Boxer, you can go first.
Well, I think round three, 78. First of all, the difference was 15 shots.
Correct.
That's the difference, which is a hell of a lot. The course setup was incredibly difficult. They must have known the weather was coming. I think it was probably five or six pin positions, more than anything else. They always know it's going to be windy, but I think the pin positions, five or six, were a bit ridiculous. But then for the round four, it was set up, and if you hit it out the middle of the club, you could shoot a 63 or a 64 or a 65, as was proved on the last day. But if you're not on your game, and a US Open course will always find you out, you can still shoot 78, 79. And I think that was the difference. It was the breeze wasn't as strong, but the course or the pin positions in particular were set up a lot fairer. What do you think, Bob?
I think that Mike Davis came in and apologized for the course setup on Saturday. He probably should have come in on Sunday and apologized for the course setup, because Saturday, round three, he made it too hard, and round four, he made it too easy. If they were holding their club championship at Shinnecock, and on the final day, they offered the members those hole locations, the members would be screaming. I mean, so many of them were in the middle of the green. I mean, you know, they had to do that, though. They had to, you know, back off of what they did on Saturday.
We'll touch on the course again a little later in the show. Just back to the final round. Brooks Koepka, obviously, with that last day, 68, Bob. Do you felt that he was always in control? He did make three bogeys over the course of the 18. One on the last was fairly irrelevant, I guess, but he always seemed to keep the rest of the field at bay.
He did. He looked very comfortable with the putter, which is a trademark of, you know, Brooks's now. You know, he's just a talented player. There is no doubt in my mind he did not get the credit that he deserved for winning at Erin Hills. All the focus was on the golf course and you know, how different it was from a standard U.S. Open. So nobody ever got down to pointing out, you know, how much talent Brooks Koepka really has. But now it cannot be denied. I mean, only six times in history somebody wins back-to-back U.S. Opens. The last time, what was it, 88, 89 with Curtis Strange? Trust me, Curtis Strange and his career in broadcasting, he never thought that he would see anybody that would duplicate that. And he had every right to think that. I mean, it's hard enough, obviously, to win a U.S. Open. To win back-to-back U.S. Opens, I mean, it's incredible.
It really is very impressive. But you've got to say, Bob, I was sitting at home pouring myself a soft drink and I was watching the finish of it. And it, from the 10th, I thought it was 10, 11, 12, he's putting. If he hadn't, he wouldn't have won it if he hadn't all those fantastic putts on, I think it was about three or four holes on the spins for saves, you know, for pars. Brilliant putts.
Yeah, absolutely. And probably the one that got him going the most. I mean, number 11 is a delightful little par 3. It's only 157 yards, but you better have it on the green. Brooks Koepka was not on the green. I mean, it looked like he could make a double bogey, maybe even worse on that hole. He makes a you know, relatively long putt to save bogey, and that did not deflate him when he got to the 12th hole. Richie, you know, you've played this game enough. I've always felt that a critical putt for bogey or a critical putt for par does more for your round than rolling in a birdie or an eagle putt.
Yeah, I think, you know, I remember you and I have had this discussion at Opens before. You know, you'd much rather, like on the first hole, me personally, and there could be a few others, I'd rather hole from 12 feet for a par than miss from 3 feet for a birdie.
One of the secrets to Tiger's success, I have never seen a player that hated to make bogey worse than Tiger Woods. Tiger Woods would grind over a par putt far more than he would a birdie putt. And 99% of the guys in the field would always grind on those birdie putts and be somewhat casual on the par putts, but not Tiger. Tiger hated to make bogey. And as a result, he made less of them.
Lots of congratulations for Brooks on social media. Chase Koepka, his brother, of course, says, "I apologise to everyone on this flight to London for my behaviour when that last putt went in. Back to back, baby. So proud of you, BK." Jack Nicholas says, "Heartfelt congrats to Brooks Koepka. All of us in Palm Beach County are once again happy for you. To not long ago come off injury, what a nice way to play and a terrific way to win. It was a great victory, and to win back-to-back US Open golf titles, not many people have. Elite fraternity." Let's hear from the US Open champion next. Here's what Brooks Koepka made of his final round.
"I felt like I made those clutch 8 to 10 footers that you need to make to kind of keep the momentum going. You know, we didn't drive it that great, but, you know, you can make up so much with a hot putter. And I feel like that's kind of what I was doing. Starting with the great bogey I made at 11, I think that was big, because from where we were, honestly, I would have taken double. You can't miss it there, and you know, to make that big of a mistake, you just want to walk away with bogey. And luckily that putt went in, and that kind of that built some momentum coming down the stretch and made me feel a little bit better with the putter. Rich Beam at the Open Championship was talking about how there's only 280 some guys that have ever won a major. And once you keep doing it, I mean, once you win the second one, he told me it goes down a lot lower. What'd you say, 80? Yeah, I think that's, it's pretty incredible to be a two-time major champion. I think that's neat, man. It really is.
And even more incredible to think that he was 7 over par at one point during his second round. You can't get too down about your over par score, it would appear, in the US Open, because we saw players in that first round, and I'm talking top players here, the Spieths, the McIlroys, maybe just lose their discipline a little bit on course, and you can't believe that it's over until it's over with the US Open, because you can battle back.
I think Koepka summed it up there. It's a grinding situation. You know, you just got to keep grinding and grinding and grinding away. And as we discussed earlier, Bob was chatting about it, I was, you were. He's putting. He holds some clutch putts that were, I mean, that one on the 11th, it was uphill putt as well. It was slow. Everybody was coming up short, you know, from that side of the hole. And that's what you got to do. You got to roll them in, you know. And as Bob said earlier, it's not always the birdie putts that win you the event.
No, Bob, was the difference between Dustin Johnson and Brooks Koepka simply the putting, because Dustin wasn't making anything?
Dustin, you know, he blows hot and cold. But I want to make one more point. I thought it was very intelligent of Brooks Koepka. He went and played the European Tour. He just said, I want to play, I want to play, I want to play. I don't care where I play. I think he ends up winning in Turkey or something. But that seems to be a very popular formula now. You know, when I see Peter Uihlein, his dad, Wally Uihlein, head of Titleist for so many years, going the route of the European Tour. I mean, it speaks volumes for the European Tour. The level of play is better. The travel is, you know, not as long, but certainly not as easy. And if you can prove your mettle playing on the European Tour, I think then you're in a better position to do well in the big events and the majors. You know, you have to put Brooks Koepka's accomplishment in perspective simply by saying, you know, Tom Watson, Gary Player, Jack Nicklaus, Tiger Woods, not one of those guys did what Brooks did yesterday.
Bob was talking about Peter Uihlein then. Between the two of them, Uihlein won in Madeira, so he won first. And they actually rated Uihlein as a better player than Brooks Koepka. As it happens so far with the results, it hasn't turned out
they're
like that.
They're good pals, aren't they, those
yeah,
two?
Yeah, no, they're good mates. And every time they won an event, they said, right, well the other one would buy somebody like a jet ski or something like that. I mean, it was...
That's a bit random, isn't it?
It is a bit random, yeah. But anyway, but that's what they were. You know, they probably still are great mates. But European Tour is a strong tour. They don't, you know, I don't know, Bob, you're not sort of saying they come over here just to practice and think, right, now we're going to go and play in America. They, you know, it's a tough tour over here as well.
No, I'm saying it's extremely tough.
Yeah.
And there's many talented players there. And, you know, guys have finally realizing, especially the younger guys in the early to mid-20s, and I've said it for years, I mean, why not go see the world? I mean, the European Tour plays in so many exotic places and, you know, work on your game. You know, if you think you're good, let's go over there and see if you can win. I'll tell you what, Thomas Bjorn had to be delighted when you look at that top 15 yesterday. How many are going to be in Paris when we get there for the Ryder Cup? I mean, it's amazing.
One player that will definitely be there for the European Ryder Cup team is Tommy Fleetwood, and we can hear from the runner-up at Shinnecock Hills now as he reflects on his final round 63.
So many positives, so many great things. I had a chance of shooting a 62, and at the end of the day, I got within one of winning when I was so far back at the start of the day. So it's been a great day. It's easy to look at it and think, I was one shy, and you can be disappointed, but there's so many positives to look at and so much that you can take from it and learn from it. And again, it's another major where I've ended up sort of up there at the end of the day. Majors and tournaments are 72 holes, so it doesn't matter how you kind of do it. If you end up there at the end of the week, it's a positive. I thought if the conditions were a bit more like yesterday, I'd have felt a lot more comfy in the clubhouse. I thought I'd have felt I'd have had a bit more of a chance, but the best players in the world were up there trying to win a US Open, and watching him down the stretch, you've got nothing but respect for how well Brooks did. Just hold the putts at the right time, he kept it together, and he's a world player, he's one of the best players in the world, and it was Well, it wasn't great for me, but it was great as a golfer to watch how he did it and watch how he closed it out. The putt on 18, I actually wanted more for the 62 at the time. Obviously, that's the putt that you can that will play on your mind, because that was the last shot you hit and that was your chance. But I missed some putts in the week. I made some putts. I think everybody did. Your score is your score. I'm not going to dwell too much on it. It is what it is. But again, I got very close to winning a major.
Bob, Tommy says he's not going to dwell on it, but you sense that he will do. And as the days go on, certainly this week, he's going to think, crikey, I was so, so close at the US Open.
At this juncture in Tommy Fleetwood's career, especially leaving the golf course yesterday, he had to wait around a long time to see if he was going to be involved in a playoff or maybe even win it outright. When he left the property, I don't think there's a shadow of a doubt in Tommy Fleetwood's mind that one day he is going to win a major. I mean, he was treated like a rock star over here. I mean, with the flowing hair and the flamboyant walk that he has and always a smile on his face. I mean, he was a sheer delight. And I did not do my homework, but I would almost guarantee that any of the years that somebody won back-to-back U.S. Opens, I don't think there was anybody else in the field that finished in the top four in both of those Opens. I mean, you know, fourth and second, back-to-back, you know, we're certainly excited about what Brooks Koepka did, but we can't overlook what Tommy Fleetwood accomplished. I mean, you finish fourth and then you come back the following year and finish second on a completely different style golf course. That just shows the variety of talent possessed by Tommy Fleetwood.
One thing we don't see as well either, Boxy, is a European being celebrated and championed by New York galleries, by American galleries, because they were rooting for Tommy, weren't they?
Yeah, oh no, they got a standing ovation, didn't they, on the last hole?
They treated Tommy Fleetwood they enjoyed his performance. They marveled at his talent, and they were certainly impressed by his style, because we don't have an American player currently that even comes close to the flair of a Tommy Fleetwood.
Well, Fleetwood 63, on the 45th anniversary of Johnny Miller shooting the same score to win this title at Oakmont, equaled the record for both the lowest score in US Open history and the lowest score on the final day of a major. And here's what the champion, Brooks Koepka, made of seeing Fleetwood's charge through the field on the on-course leaderboards.
63 in a US Open's always pretty impressive. It was hard not to miss. It was the lowest red number up there. 700 is incredible. Hats off to him. That's some golf. He seems to bring it every time it's a US Open. I mean, last year playing with him in the final round, it was pretty impressive. He played very well. He's an incredible player. He'll definitely be holding some major championships here soon.
A lot of respect between those two, Boxing.
Yeah, I mean, they're all good players. It's just who it falls right for on the day, seriously.
It didn't fall right for the world number one, Dustin Johnson, who finished at three over, a shot clear of Masters Tournament champion Patrick Reed, and two ahead of Tony Finau. Dustin Johnson on social media said, "Just wasn't my day, but ended on a high note. Congrats to Brooks Koepka on a well-deserved win." Your thoughts on Johnson over the course of the week, Boxy, first of all, because he keeps getting these very fast starts in majors and big events over the last year or so, but doesn't always win them. Wins more than his fair share, you would say, but he was trading odds on with the bookmakers at halfway.
He was, but, you know, you've got to take into view, I think it's a fine performance of Dustin Johnson after holding his second shot at the St. Jude Classic to win by six and then come on and finish there the next week. I mean, they're sort of almost superhuman, really, because, you know, if you do well, to get up for the next week mentally is so difficult, because you've been at the top of the leaderboard all the way through the event. When you finished, when you come back to a new event, all you want to do is get to the top of the leaderboard again. And sometimes it's very hard to get up there. So I admire Dustin Johnson. That's why he's up there at world number one. I am always in awe at how they get themselves up for the tournaments, for them, in inverted commas, that matter.
Nobody has ever won the week before and gone on to win the U.S. Open. So there must be something to that. And, you know, all the hoopla with victory and the ceremony and the elation and, you know, you're really feeling good about your game. And then, you know, within a span of a few hours, you're back to, you know, zero. You got to start again. I think Dustin Johnson played really well. I think his putter went cold. He's certainly, well, he's ranked the number one player in the world. You know, there are a couple of guys that, you know, are in that elite company. You know, I would put Rory McIlroy in there, even though he certainly didn't demonstrate any form here. Probably had the most unusual response upon missing the cut. When asked by a Irish radio announcer that I know very well, what do you think went wrong, Rory? And he said he wasn't ready for the wind. Then everybody else in the media demanded to see his passport. You know, we thought you were from Northern Ireland, you know, so how you cannot be ready for the wind, it seemed a bit strange. But it just wasn't Rory McIlroy's week. But, hey, don't count that guy out. I mean, he liable to win at Carnoustie, liable to win at Belrive at the PGA Championship. That's how much talent Rory McIlroy has.
Well, Tyrrell Hatton and Sweden's Henrik Stenson were in a group tied sixth at six over par. Let's hear where the Swede thought his US Open challenge faltered.
It was more on the back nine yesterday. I mean, I played my best round of golf for the week was yesterday. I was grinding it out and made some really good stuff on the front nine to hit the turn one under, which was more than excellent, I think, in those conditions. And, you know, five bogeys coming home were two or three more than I really should have done. A couple of bad clubs and a couple of bad decisions on the back nine yesterday, and that felt like I just played my way out of contention a little bit, even though I was only two behind at the start of the day. It felt like if I was going to win this, I would have liked to be right there with the threes starting the day, because I didn't feel like I had my best game today, and to make up ground on whoever was going to play the best out of those five or six guys, it was going to be hard with the game I had today.
Frustrated Henrik Stenson, certainly in his final round, no doubt about that, and indeed late on the Saturday. Honourable mentions from a European point of view for Tyrrell Hatton, who was sixth alongside Henrik Stenson. Justin Rose got himself in a great position at halfway, but then unfortunately tailed off. We saw Ian Poulter challenge. It went wrong for him very late on the Friday, but there was lots of good news stories from a European point of view.
Yeah, I thought, you know, Tyrrell Hatton was the... We didn't see a massive amount of Tyrrell Hatton during the whole week. And a 72-69 at the weekend for Tyrrell Hatton. Was it 72 he shot? Yeah, it was. That was a brilliant score. 72 was like four under on Saturday.
Let's get the top 10, Boxy, from the US Open 2018.
OK, top 10. Two players tied 10th. Webb Simpson and Justin Rose. They were at 7 over par. And then tied 6, 7, 8 and 9. There was Berger, Stenson, Tyrrell Hatton and Schauffele. And then 5th on his own was Tony Finau. Patrick Reed finished 4th. 3rd was Dustin Johnson. 2nd, Tommy Fleetwood with that excellent round of 63. And back-to-back champion Brooks Koepka.
We heard Bob talk about Rory McIlroy or explain one or two press reports on Rory's missed cut. What was your take on it and generally his play over the course of this season, his win aside?
My thoughts were the US Open really was done and dusted for him in the first nine on the first day. I think he got
But it shouldn't
two.
Be, should it? We've seen players
be,
battle back.
Trust me, as a player, sometimes you get to a point where I think he was about 10 over after 11 or something, or 7 over after 9, whatever it was. It was a load over par. And you know what? You're not going, well, if I can play well, I can finish 30th and pick up a nice few dollars. You're not thinking that because they're down to their last 485 million. So they're not bothered about the dough. You know, it's the silverware they want. And they're almost mentally, I mean, you wouldn't be human if you didn't think like this. You know, if you're 7 or 8 over after 9 or 10 holes, you are actually sort of saying, do you know what, this is done and dusted. It's not 7 or 8 over after 16 holes. It's a well over after the first 9. And you think, that's the end of the US Open for 2018.
Bob, Rory wasn't the only big name to miss the cut. Tiger Woods, your thoughts on Tiger's performance in his latest attempt to get that 15th major? How do you think he fared? Do you think he's close? I know he's missed the cut here. What was your take on his Shinnecock performance?
I don't know. I mean, you know, the deeper we get into this season, you know, this was supposed to be it. He showed flashes of brilliance. We're liable to show up at Carnoustie. He's liable to run away with it. He's liable to miss the cut. I don't know which way is more likely. I mean, it's somewhat of a mystery. I mean, he is 42 years old. He wasn't walking at Shinnecock like I've seen him the last couple of months. So is that back, starting to act up because he's playing and competing and practicing? I don't really know. It didn't seem to be a 100% fit Tiger Woods when he teed off on Thursday.
And what about Jordan Spieth? Because every single time I see him over a short putt, he seems to miss it at the moment. It seems to be really bothering him. He can't do anything about it.
Great observation. And probably the cruelest thing that happened last week was Jordan Spieth. He runs off four birdies in a row on Friday. He's got his mom and dad following every shot, his fiance, every shot, his brother is in the group. They were a mere few feet away on the last hole on Friday, 4 or 5 foot putt. He gets to play the weekend, doesn't make it. He, as you just said, he's had problems with short putts for the last 3 or 4 months. But Richard Boxall it will certainly tell you, that for a while, Jordan Spieth was making 20 and 25-foot putts like other people made 2 and 3-foot putts.
Yeah, he was.
And in all honesty, Boxy, if that was possible, this wouldn't be a great game. I mean, if everybody could go up and make 20, 25-foot putts, this would be the easiest sport. And I just had the feeling when he was doing that, I said, at some juncture, you run out of doing that. And as soon as you start thinking at all that you're not going to make that 20, 25-foot putt, then your attention goes to how short am I going to leave it? I got to get it close. On the par three, he makes on 17, he makes 4 birdies in a row. He hits a great shot into 17. And then, he leaves it 4 feet short of the hole. I mean, if he raced it 4 feet by, I would have thought that, it would have indicated that he was better off mentally. But hey, he's won 3 majors. He's young. Jury's still out on Jordan Spieth.
Spieth, sure to bounce back, you would have thought. Let's deal with a few of the issues out of the US Open next. First of all, the Shinnecock Hills course itself and the way that it was set up, particularly on Saturday. Let's hear from Fleetwood again. But first, third place Patrick Reed.
Yesterday, I didn't even think the golf course was unfair. I just felt like two pins, the pin on 13 and 15, if they were 2 paces closer to the middle of the green, the golf course would have played fine. No one really would have complained. When something like that happens, that all of a sudden you're coming into today, you knew that they were going to water the heck out of the greens, that they're going to be soft. And when that happens, you're taking out a lot of the bite of the golf course. And, it showed a lot of the early rounds. Fleetwood played an unbelievable round today. Goes post 7 under, and you see all these other low scores out there and guys shooting under par, which you didn't see throughout the whole week.
It battered us on Thursday and Friday morning and Saturday afternoon. There's no point complaining too much about the setup or about the conditions. It is what it is, and at the end of the week, somebody's going to win. It's a brutal golf course when the wind picks up, and that makes all the difference. Today it was a bit softer, the pins were a little bit nicer, and it's scoreable. Courses that you can shoot 7 under or 8 over in a 2-day stretch have a lot about them, and they're actually very good. But yeah, it all depends on the actual setup and how it is and the conditions. But I've really enjoyed the challenge. I've loved playing here. I love preparing for it. After playing Chambers Bay and Erin Hills, everybody told me that I haven't played like a traditional US Open course yet, so I'm glad I've done that now.
Bob, why is there such a reaction to the previous year's US Open? If a US Open is easy or deemed to be easy or scoring is double digits under par, then the next year has to be so, so tough. Is there no middle ground here?
The tradition of the U.S. Open, it was regarded as the toughest test of all the majors. And then something happened, and I can trace it back to the Masters and Augusta and the powers to be down there. They have come up with a philosophy now that they have put into play where on Sunday they like to make the whole locations very accessible. They pride themselves on the roars for the birdies and the bogeys. It never used to be that way where it would be easier on Sunday. Then, obviously, the other governing bodies have followed suit. Case in point, Royal Birkdale. I mean, Brandon Grace shooting 62 there. I talked to some members at Birkdale, and they were upset that, you know, that third round was played at less yardage than the members play the golf course. Doesn't make any sense whatsoever. And now the USGA was buying into that theory. Last year at Erin Hills, they, 16 under par, and it wasn't received well. So this year they thought, well, we got a perfect opportunity to get it right. They had a miscalculation in 2004, the last time the U.S. Open was here. They didn't put the proper amount of water on the course. They have new scientific equipment that measures the moisture, measures the firmness. That's all we heard in the buildup to this Open, and yet they get it wrong again. I mean, I don't know. I don't have the answer.
Boxy, let me ask you this. To me, it just seems very unfair if you're on the wrong side of the draw, scores can be so different to if you're on the right side of the draw.
Yes, a lot of people do come up with that suggestion to me. But you know what? When you run it through the whole year, and I can only talk from a player's point of view, we do moan and moan and moan about, it's all gone wrong, it's all gone wrong. But you know what? At the end of the day, pretty much where you start in a tournament and where you finish, and have I got the right side of the draw, it pretty evens itself out to about 50-50.
Just to give you some numbers for illustration, day one stats, 76.48. The average opening round score was the second toughest in major championship history. And a total to par for the field, 1,089 plus 1,089, making it the fifth toughest round in major championship history. That was day one of the US Open. Not just Shinnecock Hills that was being talked about, but also Phil Mickelson. I've got to ask both of you what you made of Phil Mickelson's performance, shall we say, on the 13th green on Saturday.
Okay. Bob, do you want to go first or second?
No, I want to go second on this.
Okay,
one.
All righty. Okay, my view...
Let's just explain what happened, first of all, Boxy.
Well, it was the 13th, if I remember rightly. Again, it was he was putting for a bogey down the slope from about, 10, 12 feet. It went past the difficult flag position and then carried on rolling. He then broke into a sort of a semi-trot and went round and hit the ball. The ball was going to go off the green and go 20 feet off the green. He came round and hit a moving ball on the way back and knocked it 6 feet by. And I think he missed it or may have held it. But anyway, he got a two-shot penalty for that, for hitting a moving ball, and ended up with a 10. I have never in, 57? I've never in all my life seen anyone do that. Ever have I seen that. I think he could have turned the whole thing round and made himself look a load better if he'd let the ball go all the way down to the bottom, and then pick it up and say, I'm taking it unplayable, and then go back to where he was, in my view. And then, okay, he's going to get a 9 instead of a 10. He's not going to win the tournament. Yes, he's frustrated. But I think for the sake of the crowds, I don't think I would never go round. None of my pros who I've played with would ever go round and hit a moving ball like that.
Do you buy into the fact that he said he was simply trying to take advantage of the rules and get that two-shot penalty? Or do you think he just had a brain freeze? Do you think, it just got too much, the whole situation got too much for him?
No, I think he got to a case of, why me? You know, this is unfair. Why is this happening? It's my birthday. Shouldn't be going like this. If he said, I was aware of the two-shot rule, was he aware of the one-shot rule if he let the ball go and then take a penalty of one shot?
Bob, a lot of ex-players and pundits and commentators have suggested he should have been disqualified. What did you make of the incident? Have you ever seen anything like it before? And what do you think should have happened to him or could still happen to him? How do you assess it all?
First, I agree with Boxy. I have never seen anything quite like that. The USGA was very kind in applying one rule. I think it was rule 14.6 rather than rule 1.2, or the 1.2 would have disqualified him. 14 allowed him to stay in the competition. I think that one of Phil's biggest regrets is that he wasn't, in the proper shape. Had he been able to run to that ball faster than he did, he would have been able to hit it when it was only a foot behind the hole.
That's a very good point, I never thought about that.
But here's the piece of the puzzle, because Phil, a lot of players, or a lot of people, a lot of pundits, a lot of fans, a lot of people said Phil should have withdrawn from the event. Discovered last night that Phil made a call to Mike Davis after the incident and said, Mike, it seems like this thing is getting out of control, this incident. I think I should withdraw from the event. Mike Davis said, Phil, you didn't violate a rule that would cause disqualification. You should stay in. So, you know, I think if Phil had to do it over again, he would have WD'd and because he wasn't going to win. But and the expectations were so high for Phil Mickelson. When you look at the fact that the last time the Open was played here, he finished second. He made a double bogey on the par 5 16th hole. He won earlier this year in Mexico. He's finished second six times in the U.S. Open. He's 48 years old. He wanted to complete that career Grand Slam. Who wouldn't? So everything rolled into the frustration that Phil put on display on that hole. Do I condone it? Absolutely not. And I know Phil that he wouldn't do it again. Impartial, though, I got to be candid. He was sending a message to the USGA that, you know, the course conditions weren't fair. And what backs Phil's point up is the fact that Mike Davis, a couple of hours later, came in and apologized for the course conditions. So Phil sending a message that it wasn't fair, they got the message.
No doubt about that. Phil Mickelson, incidentally, was tipped up by one of our guests last week. We have got our presenter versus co-presenter head-to-head, of course. Two picks each. One pick has to be from outside of the top 50 in the final 2017 R2D standings, although last week, of course, because it was a major, we waived that rule. 20 points for a winner, 10 for a top 5, 5 for a top 20, a minus 5 for a miscut. Robert Lee went for lefty, who in the end finished tied 48th. No points for that, but he did pick out Justin Rose to get 5 points. Jamie Spence was on duty last week. He went for Messrs Rose and Day to pick up nil points. 5 points for Justin Rose, minus 5 for Jason Day. And Bob, you went for Rory McIlroy and also Brant Snedeker. You were minus 5 on the week, which was the worst score of our trio, as Rory missed the cut and Brant was tied 48th. So, unfortunately, you didn't add anything to the guest presenter's tally.
Unfortunately, the signal has just broke up. I didn't hear what you just said.
No, I think it was something like useless or something like that, but I can't remember how it finished. It was one of the words I heard coming out.
The overall score, presenter on 110, co-presenter on 30. Bob, before we let you go, your final thoughts on what's been an extraordinary 2018 US Open. What is it going to be remembered for? Will it be Mickelson? Will it be the course? Or will it be Brooks Koepka's second major win?
Ultimately, it'll be Brooks Koepka because of the fact that it's back-to-back U.S. Open wins, a feat that is so difficult. When you can say anything in golf that Jack Nicklaus was not able to do and Tiger Woods was not able to do and Tom Watson and Gary Player and the list goes on, when you're capable of achieving that they could not, you'll be remembered for doing something very special, and that's exactly what Brooks Koepka did over the 4 days playing at Shinnecock.
Bob, great to speak to you. Thanks for coming on the Race to Dubai show. We will speak again soon.
Loved it, guys. Take care.
In the Fantasy Race to Dubai game, Marco Mannucci still tops the overall global standings, while Peter Pullen got the most points last week. In the Race to Dubai Show Mini League, Jeremiah Lynch now leads the way, but it's congratulations to fellow listener Steve Halston, who got the most points from the US Open. Richard, we need the top 10 in the Race to Dubai standings.
Okay, in 10th spot, Shubhankar Sharma from India. He's in 10th. Tobias Olesen is 9th. 8th is Tyrrell Hatton. 7th is Alex Noren. Rafael Cabrera Bayo is 6th. 5th is Kiradek Appibarnrat. Rory McIlroy is 4th. Francesco Molinari, 3rd. 2nd is Tommy Fleetwood. And it's the American Patrick Reed who leads the way in the Race to Dubai.
What about the Ryder Cup standings?
Well, the Ryder Cup standings, I'll give you it from the world points, first of all. From the world points, John Rahm, Rory McIlroy, Alex Noren and Matthew Fitzpatrick are 3rd, 4th, 7th and 8th. Four from that, and then you get four from the European points, and the top four in that are Tyrrell Hatton, Justin Rose, Tommy Fleetwood, and Francesco Molinari. So all in all, it's actually shaping up very well.
World number one spot has been yo-yoing around a little bit over the course of the last year. What sort of changes in the top 10 when it comes to the best players on the planet?
On the planet. Well, Tommy Fleetwood is now up into 10th spot in the world rankings. Jason Day is 9th. Ricky Fowler's 8th. 7th is now Rory McIlroy. John Rahm is 6th. Jordan Spieth is 5th. Brooks Koepka up to 4th. Justin Rose is 3rd. Justin Thomas is 2nd, but it's still Dustin Johnson who's leading the way.
And a couple of other news lines to bring you this week. First of all, Stuart Manley defeated Grant Forrest on the 3rd playoff hole to win the Eau de France Golf Open and claim his 2nd career European Challenge Tour victory. The Welshman lost in a playoff at last week's KPMG Trophy. Clark Dennis successfully defended the Senior Italian Open presented by Villa Verde Resort, winning the title after a playoff once again. He's the first player to win the event twice. A 25-foot birdie putt on the last forced the playoff with the Argentine Rafael Gomez, who had led for most of the day, but three-putted for bogey on 18. And Francesco Molinari has been named Hilton Golfer of the Month for May after his victory at the BMW PGA Championship. The Italian claimed a massive 62% of the fan vote. Plus, don't forget to check out a brand new podcast from the European Tour called Life on Tour. The series features in-depth interviews with some great characters, and it's available on Acast. And you can also subscribe now at Apple Podcasts via iTunes. By the way, Luke Donald features in the first episode. On to this week's event next. We've got the BMW International Open coming up. Andrés Romero, rolling back the years. Last campaign, is the defending champion. We are at Golf Club Gutlachenhof. Have I got that right, Boxy? Because you are on your way there.
Yes, last
Tell us about
year,
the course. Tell us about the course.
Okay, I will. This one is, let me think about it. It's great two, for either 9 or 9 and 18, you've got two great finishing holes. It dogleg from right to left with water all the way down the left-hand side at Larkenhof, and then on the 9th, on the first 2 days, it'll obviously be 2-tee start. You've got water down the right-hand side and a little dogleg from left to right. So two great finishing holes designed by Jack Nicklaus. So the fairways are quite wide, and it's got the great thing about his design is he's, you know, he always says a good shot should not be punished. And it's sort of one of those golf courses, but expect low score. Sorry,
you've just been reading my notes here because it says this is what Jack has said about it. It says one of the most attractive and interesting golf layouts in Germany, fulfilling all the criteria of a top world-class golf design. It's shaped by the guiding philosophy of its architect Jack Nicklaus. A good shot should not be punished.
No, I mean,
did you actually know that? You just knew that off by heart. You just knew stuff like that. Yeah.
Well, I always...
It goes on to say, consequently...
But Richard Boxer would always do well around my course.
I'm not so sure. Yeah. It says, consequently, it's challenging and diverse, but always fair, rewarding players who use intelligence and precision rather than strength alone. You got that?
Yeah, you want me to answer that?
I'm just, you know...
I like Jack Nicklaus golf courses. Mm-hmm. I really do. I think they're nice and... I think one of the reasons I like them is because the fairways are all fairly generous. They're quite wide fairways. Do you want to read that last paragraph?
He says, the degree of difficulty was planned so that the final parts of both the front nine and the back nine feature the most challenging holes, which ensures an exciting finish. Each fairway was individually modelled. All drive zones designed that they are visible from the tee, and the hilly green landscape demands a precise short game. Something for everyone there, Boxy.
There is something for everybody there. It'll be, as I say, the greens are normally very good, and I think it'll be quite low scoring going there in June time. It'll be hot. It gets quite hot there. You can possibly expect some delays in the respect of thunderstorms, stuff like that.
What sort of player is going to prosper?
One that stays one ahead, I reckon, than the rest of the field.
The one that shoots the lowest score.
Yeah, I would have said. But I'll give you a few names who's playing. The winner of the US Open, to be confirmed. I doubt very much whether he'll be playing, Brooks Koepka. Tommy Fleetwood, he's down here to play. Is he going to play? Watch this space. Might well do
How
that.
How difficult is it to play off the back of something like that, where it's a mental test as well as a physical test?
Very difficult. Listen, I can only relate it to things that I've done, and I've never finished second in the US Open.
After your Rolex Series win.
After the fifth major, yes, and then put your hand on
what did you do the next performance? What did you do?
I'll tell you what I did. We played it in May. The next tournament was the BMW PGA at Wentworth.
Yeah? How'd you get on?
The trouble with it, here's the thing.
Because the pressure was on you that week.
Yeah, well, so you're back at
here
home.
He comes,
I only live around
Rolex,
the corner.
Rolex Series event winner.
Dick returns. from Italy. So anyway, I turned out, and the trouble was the tournament started on a Friday, finished on a bank holiday Monday. Mm-hmm. So the days were running out of that wave, sitting on top of that wave. So I went in and I went out and had a normal practice round, and then I played the Pro-Am, and I went out and shot 67, beat Faldo by a shot. It was a windy day, and I won a watch. Then I went out, and I'm not going to bore you, put a glove on and a pair of shoes. But then when the tournament started, I played with Mark James, and I think the other one was Mark McNulty. And at Wentworth, it was the old style of Wentworth. And I started birdie, up and down for a par, eagle.
Hello.
Four under after four. I thought, is only back-to-back, so I can't believe it. This is so easy. And ended up finishing reserve money on Sunday afternoon. I'm mentally absolutely knackered, I'm afraid, at the end of it.
So,
but anyway,
be interested to see if Tommy Fleetwood plays and if he does, how well he plays. Sergio Garcia, Martin Kaymer, major winners both teeing up.
Chris
Sergio's
Wood.
Done not so much this year. Martin showed flashes, hasn't he?
A little when you say flashes, whatever you say.
Flashes of form.
Oh, sorry, yeah. Yeah, listen, as time moves on, you know, these players can't keep going and going and going forever. The wheel turns, people fall off the cog. You know, you just can't. He's a great player, Martin Kaymer.
So what you're saying, he can't win this week?
Oh, he could win, yeah. I just, you know, how long's Martin been a pro now? I've got my notes here in front of me, I could tell you, but Kaymer must have turned pro in about, what, 99?
Well, he's Challenge Tour graduate, wasn't he?
Well, they fired it all out. But it's 20 years, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Must be.
Well, I don't think it's 20.
It's not far off, I'll tell you. But anyway, no, I don't think Martin Kaymer will win. I don't think Ernie Els will win.
Sorry, Martin, if you're listening.
Sorry, Martin, if you're listening.
I know
Chris Wood, I think, might have a chance of winning. He's a good player.
Yeah.
Matt Wallace, you've got the youngsters. You've got Pepperall and Wallace there coming into it now.
Mikko Kohonen after his last time.
Yes, no, he's an older man now, you know, but I don't.
You're striking through these at a serious rate, aren't you?
I know.
Thomas Peters needs to find a bit more, doesn't
he? Yeah, he does.
Because every time I speak to you guys, you want him in that Ryder Cup team because of what he did last time on a losing side. What has he got to do to get close to that team if he's not there on merit?
I think with Thomas Peters, you know what? I think if Thomas Peters, would you say if he was in the top 20 of one of the rankings, would you pick him?
I don't think top 20 is enough. I think he's got to be almost next cab off the rank.
Yeah.
Or two at least.
No, I'll go for five in either list.
I think that might be too many.
It might be, but you never know what Thomas Bjorn's thinking.
Torbjørn Olsen.
Could he win?
Yeah. I'm going to throw some names at you.
Okay, yeah. They could all win. It's whether, you know, who gets a bit of luck at the right time. Simple as that. Your hand in the air. Can that cut?
No, it's not a cut. We're just sort of trying to find out how good your Martin Kaymer knowledge is. And his Challenge Tour wins back in 2006. So he's not really been on tour for 20 years.
Right, no, well, I'm well out. Just go. So that's what happens
exactly.
To get 57.
Mm.
So you're getting that in the air and they're not keying it through to me. That's nice, isn't it?
That's what happens.
That's what happens in this game.
Of course
isn't it
is.
We're so close across this table.
You know,
here.
Come on. You've rubbished most of the good players. So who do you like this week?
Okay, oh, you want two picks?
Yeah, why not?
Yeah, all right, okay. I'll go for Jacques Kruijswijk from South Africa.
Oh, shrewd. Shrewd. Why?
Good player. He's has won.
Yeah.
Or has he?
On the Sunshine Tour.
On the Sunshine Tour. Not won yet on the European Tour, but features quite a lot.
On leaderboards.
On leaderboards. Mm. So Jacques Kruijswijk, young South African, good player. And for my tip outside the top 2017 on the Race to Dubai...
Not outside the top 2017.
No, what did I say? No, outside the top 50.
You'll be struggling for someone
what
then.
What time is it? right, yeah, my tip for outside the top 50 in 2017. I will be struggling. And you are going to love this.
Go on.
You're going to love this. Oh, Andy Sullivan.
What number was he?
62nd.
You've pulled that one out.
I did, yeah.
You've absolutely cheated there.
Three wins, all coming in 2015, okay. And he's just starting to play nicely now.
I'm going to go for Justin Walters, who played well in the Shot Clock Masters.
Okay, that's fair, dude.
In top 35s prior to that. And my second pick is going to be Marcus Chenault. He had a terrific amateur career. He's not really kicked on as much as we thought.
Chenault spelt with a K.
Correct.
Okay, right, okay. Now, you follow a lot of these players that come like these graduates from the Challenge Tour, don't you?
Absolutely.
All right, I hear some music coming in my ears. Maybe it's time to stop talking.
That is, in fact, your lot. You've absolutely nailed that one, Boxy. It's about the only thing over the past 4.5 hours we've had to record this one. Next week, we will review the BMW International Open and look ahead to the H&A Open de France, part of the Rolex series. Until then, you can stay up to date with all the latest news on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram and Snapchat via europeantour.com or by downloading the official app. But for now, from Richard Boxall, bye. And from myself, Dan Roebuck, it is goodbye. We will see you next time.